Afro-Semitic Experience playing Eliyahu Hanavi. And you are also listening to WNHH Radio's High Haven, a program about everything Jewish in our community. Today in our studio, we're fortunate to have Marcy Bello, the rabbi of Beth Shalom Road Faith Tzedek, otherwise known as the Chester Synagogue, right? Mm-hmm. A congregation on the move on the shoreline. Also with us, we have Ellen Nodelman, author of a new book about the congregation, and the New Haven Independent's own Alan Appel, who is an active member and will be guiding this conversation. Welcome, everybody.
Thank you.
Hi, Paul. Hi, everybody.
Good. How are the last weeks of sin repudiation and expiation going before we get to Rosh Hashanah?
It's always a mad dash, but we pull it off every year.
And we got those extra breadcrumbs to throw in the river on the last week, the first day, right? Just in case we don't settle the whole thing. Well, so Alan, I understand you got your hands on this new book that Ellen has written about the congregation.
Well, what I've got my hands on, Paul, is something called the Whole Megillah, which is the regular bulletin from this synagogue.
Oh, okay.
And full disclosure, I am a member of the synagogue, which is kind of shocking to me because many times in my life I swore I would never, ever become a member of a congregation ever again.
At least any congregation that would have you as a member.
Yeah, any congregation.
But you're always going to have the shul you don't go to, right across from your street.
Well, you're right, and you're always looking for the perfect place, and they all turn out to be imperfect.
But you know what's interesting to me about that, Alan? Your life has been so deeply intertwined with Judaism. I mean, ever you went to seminary, Jewish Theological Seminary.
I did. I'm a proud dropout of the Jewish Theological Seminary.
I mean, you know so much more about Judaism than I do, and you know so much about texts and Jewish history, and you study with rabbis. Why wouldn't you want to be a member of a congregation?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, my connection to Jewish things is through study. And the kind of congregational involvement, that is, I don't know, brotherhood and sisterhood, watching my parents being uncomfortable with that, overhearing phone conversations from the executive director, dunning my poor gambling dad for the overdue monthly assessment. Hmm. It really, because I grew up relatively poor in Los Angeles in an upwardly mobile neighborhood. So synagogue membership was kind of fraught for me. But I did go to Hebrew school and had wonderful teachers, and the text study really became the through line for me.
Well, there have been studies done that people who went to Hebrew school, like me, actually had a higher percentage of not belonging to congregations,
right,
until some of us got to be older and we discovered some of the joys of Judaism and communal life,
right,
that in the 60s.
Right.
Were not always so apparent in the way it was being handed
right
down.
Well, Paul, this brings me right to our guests here, Rabbi Bellows, who's been the rabbi. I think this is a year and a half or so that you're,
yep,
into your assignment after having spent 8 years on Long Island.
Yeah, I was 7 years on Long Island and 5 years in Manhattan before that.
Right, and Ellen Nodelman, who's the author of the about to be published history of this wonderful synagogue, which we should identify as Congregation Beth Shalom Road Faith Tzedek, or CBSRZ, which challenges everybody's dyslexia, but it's a name of great affection. But Ellen, you've been a member of the synagogue for a long, long time.
Well, not that long, since 2004.
2004.
Yeah.
But this synagogue goes back more than 100 years. This
it
is
does.
One of our. Are not only is it a historic synagogue, but it's one of those places, like a handful in America, whose origins go back to Jewish chicken farmers and, mm-hmm, dairy farmers. Are these refugees from the pogroms in Europe?
Yeah,
Paul, just in the same way that John Jay at Becky told you the story of his relatives. So tell us a bit about the synagogue, which is in Chester. Is that Middlesex? Middlesex County?
Yeah.
And it's a synagogue of how many families? And tell us how it came about, because the CBSRZ is like a law firm where various firms, but in this case, farmers, Jewish communities merged.
Yeah. Well, there's some people who prefer to refer to the congregation as a congregation with a long name,
right,
which, of course, is moot. But Rudvezetic was the first synagogue that was founded in the immediate area of Chester and Mudus. It was founded in Mudus by chicken farmers and local merchants in the town of Mudus. In fact, it was two tavern owners, Bernard Frank Scheckman, who decided it was time in 1905 before they actually had a building.
So they arrived in...
I'm going to ask you folks, Ellen, if you can come a little closer to the microphone.
Yeah.
So
okay. 1905, Ellen, is that correct?
Yeah, but people started coming into the East Haddam area in the 1880s. 1880s.
So
of
they just arrived from Europe. They didn't, or did they come
from
New York?
Some of them came into New York and then came out from New York into the East Haddam area. And the reason they came there was that there was, at that point, something called the Baron de Hirsch Fund, which supported people who wanted to become farmers. Baron de Hirsch was a wealthy German Jew from a big banking family who was concerned with the plight of the Russians who were fleeing pogroms, etc., in Eastern Europe, and he wanted to bring them back to the land. And so he funded initiatives to bring Jewish farmers onto the land, both in North and in South America.
So these were Jews who were not farmers to begin with.
Most of them were not farmers. Most of them knew nothing about farming, although they had had, in living in the shtetls, they might have had vegetable gardens and chickens and geese in their backyards, and some of them were animal traders, so some of them knew something about farming.
And you told me that they adopted some of the more scientific new techniques that were being developed
in the beginning of the 20th century, yes, when they took advantage of some of the new techniques that were being used for engineering better chicken coops. They discovered that the benefit of vitamin D in milk for... and so people were willing to try out things and going both into dairy and to chicken farming as opposed to subsistence farming, which would have been the original mode of farming in the area.
Because the land is tough.
The land
so,
is tough,
so we're
yeah.
talking about a handful of Jewish farmers, refugees from Europe, whatever. And when did they, after 1905, begin to feel the need to congregate?
They met with each other in their homes on an informal basis to for life events and to study Torah and to have sort of informal services that they would lead themselves. In 1905, the Scheckmans decided they needed to organize an organization, so they organized something called Hevra Rudvezetic. But they were still meeting in each other's houses
in Mudus.
In 1915, they decided. By 1914, there were 32 Jewish families in the East Haddam area, which is a significant area for a small rural area.
Right.
And so they decided to buy an old farmhouse on North Mudus Road. And they bought the farmhouse and started the actual congregational life within there. Again, they didn't have a rabbi. They didn't even have a Hebrew school. They just were able to meet there and have services there that they led themselves.
Right. One of the things that I find interesting is that Rabbi Bellows, you can tell us more than anyone else, Jews don't need to have a formal spiritual leader, as most of our listeners know. They just gather and could start with 10 people. It's so interesting to imagine the Jews doing this in kind of contrast to the way Christian communities developed on the shoreline. And those always developed when a minister had a doctrinal difference with the or somebody in the congregation, a sub-minister had a doctrinal difference. And so they broke away from Boston and went to Wethersfield. And then another guy broke away from Wethersfield and established the church in Guilford. Here, just regular folks decided that let's get together. And so when did the first... And it's too bad this building doesn't have a plaque on it, or maybe it does.
Well, the old farmhouse is no longer there.
Okay.
By 1922, they had outgrown the old farmhouse. More and more people kept coming to the meetings there, so they decided to build a house, and they built a synagogue, the first synagogue, which is still there on North Mudus Road, for the princely sum of
$4,000.
And they did most of the work themselves.
Wow.
Hired a couple of local carpenters.
And who was the first rabbi, Bellows? Who was the first rabbi?
The first rabbi who was actually hired as a rabbi was Rabbi Bernstein, Henry Bernstein, who didn't come until 1952.
52.
So it was lay-led before that.
It was lay-led, but wow. They did bring rabbis in to run the Sunday school. They called it a Sunday school.
Right.
And we saw in the minutes of the sisterhood minutes, which we read, that they sometimes referred to the rabbis not as rabbis, but as reverends, which I thought was very peculiar.
Very pure. I thought sometimes the reverends were like the shamans. Like there was a guy Beaker called for 50 years was Reverend Sidney Krauser, and he rounded up the minion every day. He was not a trained rabbi. His job was to make sure there was a minion.
So but in early American assimilation, there were rabbis who went by reverend.
Oh, there were. Okay, so it doesn't just mean elder.
Right.
So Rabbi Bellows, Marcy, when you interviewed to move from Long Island to take over the leadership, the rabbinical leadership of the synagogue, how important to you or significant or intriguing is this history?
What a great question. It has been so fascinating. You know, I'm a girl from Skokie, Illinois. You know, so I grew up in this ultimate example of Jewish life in suburbia. And coming from Long Island, which, you know, with Levittown kind of next door to where I was in Wantagh, another really exemplary example of suburbia, to come to an area where Jews have worked very hard all along to maintain their Judaism, even as a significant minority. Like you point out, the fact that it really was a grassroots community that was formed from the bottom up, that didn't have any kind of official clergy leadership for decades, says so much about how important it was for these Jews to gather as Jews. And you still very much see that in the way the congregation now, you know, over 100 years later, functions. We, even though we're located in Chester, we have members from more than 30 towns and villages and cities across the shoreline and even beyond.
And so what do you think is the draw that the kind of democratic grassroots quality that you're talking about, or is it other features of the synagogue that we would be remiss not to mention, because coming from these very, very modest farmhouse architectural roots, CBSRZ is the proud parent of one of the most distinguished architectural synagogues, I would think, in America. So to talk a bit about that and maybe an answer to the question, are they drawn both to the democracy and the history, or also to what in art circles is known as the Saul LeWitt Synagogue?
Sure. I think both. And Ellen, you know, given your 13 plus years of membership, maybe you can speak to this too. But, you know, now that I'm in my second year in this congregation, it's incredible to watch people walk into the building for the first time, just as I did, and take a deep breath the minute they walk in.
Can we describe the building? I know you brought some visuals with us, but this building is, Ellen, how to describe it? You and it's sort of in the middle of a kind of empty, kind of a plain with some grass on three sides and a parking lot. And then it's a modest one-level building, and in the middle a kind of octagon rises. And then when you enter the building, in the synagogue space, it's a kind of soaring kind of atrium with lots of wood everywhere.
And
this has been...
And carving in the wood, too.
And carving in the wood. And this was designed by the well-known conceptual artist Saul LeWitt.
Yeah. Right, who was a member of the community
for a long time. And the way the arc is designed, it follows, I don't know if we can show on Facebook Live, the actual door to the ark that holds the Torah is a Jewish star in the style of Saul LeWitt. But if I'm not mistaken, it's both new in its art and its Saul LeWitt qualities, but if I'm not mistaken, it also echoes the wooden synagogues of Poland.
I think there were two things that inspired Saul LeWitt. One was the mostly destroyed now synagogues of Eastern Europe that he wanted to evoke, but also he was also interested in the tradition of New England, the post and beam construction, the old wooden farmhouses, the old wooden synagogues. And remember that the first Rodvizetic building was a farmhouse.
That's and right, as you were saying.
Yeah, and the second one was constructed in the style of New England. So he wanted to evoke both of these, and he also wanted to express sort of the democratic ethos that is so much part of the congregation. He wanted, one of the things that he wanted to make sure was that nobody would be too far away from the beam. I didn't want to have one of these places where people were, you know, estranged from what was going on up at the Bema.
Right.
And so he pulled these together and he came up with this design, which is simply remarkable. It's, you know, you just walk in there and their windows are skylights that frame the top of the building, and the light comes in during the day. And I think Rabbi Goldenberg had talked about how Yom Kippur was a special experience because since you're spending about 24 hours in the synagogue, at night you have the you can see the moon outside the windows, and then you watch during the day as you spend all day in the synagogue, you just watch the sky and the day develop, and there's a sense of both of time and timelessness.
Yes,
about that, and I
and
think
you are listening timelessly to High Haven.
Yeah.
On WNHH Radio, 105.5 FM, live stream, newhaven.org. We're visiting with some of the forces behind the Chester Synagogue, Congregation Shalom, Road Faith Tzedek. We're here with Rabbi Marcy Bellows. We have Ellen Nodelman, a congregant who has written a new book about the history of the congregation, and the New Haven Independent's own Alan Appel, who is an active member of the congregation.
Right, and that book, the title, Ellen, this is a preview of your book. The title is House of Peace and Justice, the First 100 Years of Congregation Beth Shalom Road Faith Tzedek. I love the sense of hope. The first 100 years suggesting it's only the beginning. So let's talk a bit about that, Rabbi Bellows. I remember. So to get back to my why I became a member of the synagogue, Paul, you'll recall that I used to feel guilty about. Not going to services on Tisha B'Av.
I always wonder. I don't think I should ever feel guilty.
Not guilty,
I don't
but
think it's a mandated.
I enjoyed it. I wanted to.
What I always felt guilty about. Tisha B'Av feels like you're in a Greenwich Village club.
Yeah,
you have,
right.
You're on the floor.
You sit
with
on the floor. There are candles.
Beautiful,
that's right.
Mournful singing, and you're all kind of together and not on cell phones. Yeah.
So
you're supposed to be miserable because all these terrible things happen.
So I was out in Westbrook Tisha B'Av about a year ago, and lo and behold, I think I looked in the Shoreline Times, or I don't know what I'd heard about. The CBS RZ, and I walked into a session on Saturday, Shabbat morning, and it was a study session led by you, Rabbi Bellows, on Echa, Lamentations, which we read again, and I just loved it. And what was interesting to me is how interesting the group was, and how kind of in depth the discussion was. Given, frankly, the kind of I don't know how to put it, there was not an extensive Hebrew literacy among the group. So this is a group called Holy Scrollers,
mm-hmm.
which to me is kind of the synagogue kind of specializes in coming up with interesting names. Holy Scrollers for the study group, and their magazine is the Whole Megillah, so it's very cute, but. Is this what you were referring to about the spirit of the congregation, the kind of the grassrootsness of it? Because the discussions are very interesting, even though they're you anchor them in a lot of scholarship, which I enjoy. But you have more lawyers and professors than you can shake a stick at.
Oy, do
in
we.
This group. And you're leading them is like herding PhD cats.
Yeah, but KATZ cats.
KATZ. So tell us a bit about that. And I guess my question is, what are the challenges there? I mean, that group is more gray haired and white haired than it is youthful, and it's hard for your young family to buy an expensive house in Chester.
Mm.
Is that one of the reasons why members are coming from all over as opposed to the immediate area? What are the challenges in attracting families? And tell us about Holy Scrollers and everything else that I've asked you.
Okay, so let me try to get to everything. no, wonderful, wonderful questions. So Holy Scrollers has been meeting in some form for more than 20 years. There are people in that room every single Saturday morning studying Torah.
The Parsha of the week.
The Parsha of the week, the Torah portion of the week. And there are people there who have been engaging in these discussions and arguments and debates for decades now. What's really fascinating about it is there are people with a sense of Hebrew literacy, of actually understanding and knowing the language, knowing the Hebrew language. But you have people in the room who have an incredible amount of textual literacy, who are so familiar with the Torah, at least, if not the entire Hebrew Bible, backwards and forwards. Then you also contrast that with people who come in new all the time and
many not Jewish.
We do. So that's something very unique about this group is there have been a handful of non-Jewish members of the community who have also been coming for Torah study for many, many years and are very respectful of the fact that it is a study from a Jewish point of view of the Holy Text. But also bring other scholarship, other allusions and references to our study and to enhance our group.
And you told me this remarkable thing as we were waiting to go into the studio, that, for example, when you come to a section of the Torah about the Jubilee or letting some field lie fallow per the Torah law, you'd never been in a group where you actually have the descendants of Jewish farmers who understand this from the point of view of the soil.
Absolutely. That's been so new for me.
This gets back to the origins, right?
You know, or when there's a law that seems somewhat obscure or it's difficult to understand why you're not supposed to plow your field with an ox and a donkey and someone can speak to, well, when you're actually harvesting, you need to consider this and this and you know, the familiarity with livestock and farming and harvesting it's incredible.
Right. To say nothing of, I think the group has very sophisticated lawyers. We have a judge. I think we have a university president who shows up
yes.
now and then.
And we have professors and authors and artists and poets and also just people who enjoy coming and learning and bring their whatever their own life story is to it. So it's such a diverse group. I do have to say, when I was interviewing for the congregation, I had to be vetted separately by the Holy Scrollers. You know, there was the Rabbinic Search Committee, but then Scrollers had to sign off on me too.
Well, what did they do? Ask you to lead a session?
I had to when I came for an in-person visit to the congregation. I did have to lead a study session so they could see if I was up to the task.
But I must say, as somebody who's, a proud dropout of the JTS, you do a wonderful job anchoring the discussion that can go in many interesting directions in the text.
Thank you. That's very nice of you.
So, Ellen, what artifacts have we brought in? What have we missed talking about in the uniqueness of the synagogue, or the history, or the building?
Well, I think one of the things is the difference between the two original synagogues, one in Mutis and one in Chester. Actually, the one in Chester was originally in Deep River, although chicken farmers in Chester in the 1930s did the same things that people had done in Mutis back in the 1900s in terms of organizing themselves and meeting in each other's homes. The people in Chester and in Deep River were from the beginning much more diverse and much more far-flung. There were chicken farmers to the Isidore Romanoff and Isaac Nathanson were two of the original people who had people meet in their homes. But there were other people, you know, from further away, from Old Saybrook and from the area. So from the very beginning, the groups were more diverse in terms of not being all farmers and resort owners, but also being doctors, lawyers, and Indian chiefs.
Well, what was the trigger for the merger, which was, it took place in the 1930s,
yeah.
Is it?
No, the merger did not take place until 1998.
98?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. The two synagogues existed separately. There was they shared a rabbi for 2 years in the '60s, 1961 to 1962.
How could you share a rabbi?
They he was part time at Rudfazetic and part time at the JCC. It was the Jewish Community Center back in those days.
Okay.
But then that didn't work out because it became too difficult. He felt that he was letting one side down. And he didn't want to do that. So then he moved full time, but he moved only to Rudfazetic. He remained a part time rabbi there because they simply did not have the funds to have a full time rabbi. But he remained a part time rabbi there, and the JCC went back to having student rabbis coming in during the day. You know,
there were no theological or denominational differences between the groups, or were
originally
there?
Both were Orthodox.
Ah.
In the 1950s, both began to go towards conservative Judaism and affiliated with the conservative movement, but. The old guard was not particularly happy with that at the JCC in Deep River, and they regarded this as being something of a problem. However, they went along with it, and then later on, they were able. The first full time rabbi came in the 1970s, and he was of all things a reform rabbi. But he was willing to abide by conservative practices. At this point, the JCC was still a conservative synagogue. And then he was a great success. He was able to bring things together. But the 1970s were challenging years for both synagogues. And Rudfazetic and Mudus was a very close-knit place, very much of a family. But in the 60s, the chicken farmers were moving into other businesses, and the resorts that had emerged from the chicken farms, so many of the chicken farmers had taken in paying guests and then discovered this was much easier than raising chickens.
Right, we hadn't mentioned this, that there are many extant bungalows that are now being used by some Jewish, like Hasidic groups.
Right.
But please, go on.
Yeah. So in the 1970s, Rudfazetic began to lose membership.
Oh.
People just were not moving into Mudus anymore, or at least Jewish families were not moving into Mudus anymore.
Right.
And many of the second generations, the children of the original members, were moving away, so they were facing something of a crisis in terms of membership. That didn't stop them from building a new building, by the way.
Mm.
In 1974, they moved into a brand new building.
Right.
You know,
Lenny Bruce routine says the rabbi gets up in the pulpit and says, some people say God is dead. We're not here to talk about that. We're talking about raising money for a new building.
Exactly.
So is the idea the new building would attract people?
Didn't quite work. And then Rabbi Bernstein retired in 1988, and they never replaced him. And that was when they began to look at other possibilities. And at first they broached the possibility of getting together with people from across the river, from the Deep River Shoal. But it didn't go anywhere. It took another 10 years before that actually happened.
Mm.
Meanwhile, in the 70s, across the river, the JCC was also having some enrollment problems because I guess the 1970s was not a big period for people to come moving into the area.
Mm.
But they sort of kept going, and they brought in a couple of wonderful rabbis in the early 80s and throughout the 80s. And into the 90s, and that's when it began to develop more as a synagogue. They were able to build up the membership, and with these rabbis, and so by the 1990s, they were looking into the possibility of actually they needed a new building by this time. They'd bought a place in Deep River in 1951.
Mm.
Which is the old shul on Union Street in Deep River. But this was a wonderful place, and it was very Hamish. It was a place where people really got together. It was, again, it created, the one thing that was similar to Rudfazetic was that both of these synagogues were very family-oriented. There was a sense of belonging,
right.
Great sense of community, and of democracy as well.
Right.
But the building was falling apart. It flooded regularly. George Amaron used to have to go down and shore up the floor with 2x4s in order for the floor not to collapse while people were moving around upstairs. I mean, there were all sorts of challenges.
And so. George is in our Holy Scrollers.
Yes.
Yep, and still active.
And you are hearing about the history as well as the current revival of the Chester Shul on WNHH Radio's High Haven, your home for community radio, and WNHH 103.5 FM.
So,
live streamed at newhavenindependent.org.
Yes. Yeah. So where are we now as the second 100 years begins to unfold, Rabbi Bellows, in terms of the challenges? How do you see it, and how does the leadership of the synagogue see attracting, is it new families, and what kind, and what's a family these days?
Sure. Oh, very good questions. You know, and you asked a little bit earlier, too, what are the demographics right now in the area? What's been interesting is Chester in general, and the tri-town area of Chester and Deep River and Essex, has been wrestling with the fact that there are fewer kids in the area. And we see that at the synagogue, too. However, we just actually have had a new influx, especially of tots and toddlers over the last month, who are now coming and joining and participating in our, we call it Hot Challah on Sundays. And you don't have to be a member to bring your toddler. We take from 0 to 5 in that class. And it's a way to just kind of come and have fun in our playroom and do some Jewish stuff, but even just get comfortable in the building. And we also have a lot of new members from kind of baby boomer and up in that age range, who come and have moved to the area permanently or with us at least part of the year, and love the dynamic, but also very warm feeling that they experience. So we have about 230 families currently in our congregation.
Fabulous.
And a really high percentage of people who participate and come by.
Mm-hmm. Any chicken farmers?
Any current chicken farmers? We do have people with chickens and
sort of
goats. And goats,
thing, I was sort of like say. In your backyard for like free range net, regional diet. Yeah.
But we do a Blessing of the Animals event.
Oh, you're kidding.
And we have a family that has goats and chickens, and they love to host it at their home, and people can bring their dogs and cats and birds and
so you, we don't do lizards. The blessing in the synagogue. That's classically a church thing.
Yes, more and more synagogues have adopted it over the last number of years. Those of us who love our pets love to do it.
So does the CBSRZ invite the animals to come to into the wonderful into the building itself?
Not into the building. We are allergy sensitive.
Oh,
it's and cleanup sensitive.
Rabbi Bellows,
I think.
Do you mind if I ask, just interject? How did you become a rabbi? You grew up in Skokie, you said.
Yes.
Did you grow up with a strong Jewish identity? Was this there's a certain point in your life you decided you wanted to be at the pulpit?
So I grew up very involved in synagogue life because my mother served as the cantor of my synagogue for 26 years. So I grew up with her on the Bima. I always enjoyed going to religious school. There were times, you know, I was a madricha. I was a teaching assistant in the religious school when I was old enough, involved in youth group. I went to Brandeis University, I was really in a Jewish bubble. And yet I didn't consider becoming a rabbi or a cantor for a very long time. I went to college and majored in psychology, and also I have an extensive theater and music background.
Both of which are really handy for a rabbi.
It's true.
Well, not only that, but I happen to know the scuttlebutt at the synagogue was that when the search committee was looking for a rabbi, I'm told that it was very important that the rabbi have a kind of musical dimension.
Huh.
So I don't know if you knew that, but so I heard. And even though there's a wonderful cantor, cantor Belinda.
Mm-hmm, Belinda Brennan.
Yeah. And so, I think in a Reform synagogue, it's especially important. I don't know if that's a true statement or not, but certainly you can hear your voice as well as the cantors and your pleasure in the
so how did you,
musical aspect is there.
So what led you to become a rabbi?
Well, so there was a moment of, dare I say, an epiphany. a moment in my sophomore year of college when there was a woman rabbi leading services on campus.
What year was this?
This was 96, 97, somewhere around there. And I I looked at her on the pulpit, and it was just a wave all of a sudden. I mean, you know, we talk about maybe having a sense of calling. And in that moment, I realized, wait a minute, everything I had ever done, every skill, every talent, every passion had been leading me towards the rabbinate. And I hadn't put it together. So I realized the psychology, the theater, the music, the way I was always involved in synagogue, my love for teaching and education and learning. Took me about a year of soul searching after that to really commit to the idea. And I still got my degree in psychology, but right after graduating in May, I was accepted into Hebrew Union College rabbinical program and left for Israel in June.
So here's a question. Your predecessor was also a woman.
Yes.
And so I guess maybe that begs the question, if that's the phrase. But do you feel fully embraced? Or are some of the old chicken farmer, dairy farmer, male values coming through in the sense that they kind of don't embrace you fully as a rabbi I'm not expressing myself very, very well, but
is there
are
layered
there any
sexism?
Issues because of gender issues
sure.
at the synagogue?
At CBSRZ, really for the first time in my rabbinate, I feel completely accepted as a rabbi, period.
Even by the cranky old guys and holy
Even
scrollers.
Even by the cranky old guys and scrollers. no, but I, you know, it is very... It is all too common for women to have experiences as rabbis that are not okay.
I know because you know you do bring up of the many ways to deal with any particular text. You in scrollers, my experiences, you do pull out some of the ways Miriam and other women are treated,
sure.
and sometimes I wonder how your choice of the direction of study, for example. Is being received by everybody in the group. Maybe that's...
Well, there are always some characters and scrollers who
right.
might push back.
But you like that.
But that's okay. I don't mind that.
You engage fully in that.
Yeah, I don't mind people who come with their own lens or their own agenda, right. as long as they understand other people will equally
right.
do so.
Right.
What was really wonderful about following an incredible rabbi like Rabbi Rachel Goldenberg is... She was with the congregation for 9 years, and she also started working there with a newborn. So by the time I started working there a year ago with a newborn, my
That's
son
right.
is now 17 months old.
Right.
The congregation does that really well. So having a woman rabbi, having a rabbi who's a mom, who's actively parenting, and I'm very lucky my husband is a stay-at-home father, but the congregation is so... warm and accommodating to being a working mother.
Yes.
I might add that in the history of the congregation, back in 1941, when the Jewish Community Center was founded in Deep River, and there were two little small Jewish groups in the Deep River Chester area, and one was the Jewish Community Center. The Samuels family from Deep River were very involved in that, and Rita Samuels became president of that Jewish Community Center in 1941.
Hmm.
Possibly the first woman in the United States to be the president of a synagogue. We don't know, but you know there's a long history of having women in positions of leadership in the synagogue.
Oh yeah, that's,
and there are plenty of synagogues who will worry when both clergy are women or when there are too many women on the bima. We have a woman president right now, Maxine Klein.
Right.
Belinda Brennan is our cantor, and she also runs our religious school. And then to have me as the rabbi, and yet nobody really seems to notice.
You know, this is a revelation to me that you've encountered any, because my experience in Judaism has been that feminism has saved it and revived it. So I grew up. My girls grew up, my daughters in the 90s. They were reading Torah at the shul starting at 6 years old.
Wow.
We were having Shabbos dinner with lesbian rabbis, you know, so fermenting. The Torah reading, we do have a male rabbi, but Torah reading is always led and organized by women. They're the Gabbaim. I guess that's the wrong way of saying it, Gabbaot. I don't know. But you know, and yet I'm sure that males like me consider the job done, whereas you're clearly saying in your last congregation the job is not done.
Very much not done.
And I think I'm blind to that, probably not seeing it through your...
It's wonderful that you haven't encountered it. That is actually very
encouraging. No, but I'm the guy. I'm guessing that the women in our shul encounter it just as much as you did. I just don't see it because I'm the male.
There's a wonderful organization of which I'm a part called the Women's Rabbinic Network. And it is a kind of an umbrella organization for women rabbis of many movements, though we're primarily out of the Reform movement. And we look at issues like this. Maternity leave / family leave in general is still not in every rabbi's contract. That's something we're fighting for. Equal pay is still very much an issue. Most, I believe, women rabbis receive 80 cents on the dollar to their male colleagues. Women cantors, I think, are still at maybe 86 cents to the dollar.
Wow, the cantors too.
Yep. Yeah. Wow. And, you know, as Reformed Jews, we really advocate for equal pay. But if our synagogues, of all things, are not living that, that's a fight we really have to fight. So there are wonderful women and male allies who are fighting for these issues.
Can I ask you a Skokie question? Is that okay, Alan? You grew up in Skokie.
I grew up in Skokie.
Which, for those of us who aren't from that area, is famous for the Nazis marching in the 70s and the ACLU, led by a lot of Jews, and I happen to agree with them, feeling it was important to protect their right to march. Right. So now you just watched Charlottesville happen, where the world got a taste of what you grew up knowing about in Skokie. What was your reaction when that happened, and what did your experience in Skokie lead you to conclude about the now controversial stance of the ACLU and prominent liberal Jews, including us maybe, talking about the importance of protecting their right to march?
Ugh. So I did. I grew up in the shadow of the march. It took place, that whole incident took place in 77. I was born in 78. And being Jewish in Skokie was nevertheless still very easy. So we were aware of that. The movie Skokie with Danny Kaye was actually filmed in my home synagogue. We were aware of it, but it was still... being Jewish in Skokie was still very easy. My public high school, for instance, was maybe 75% Jewish. Hebrew was offered as a language, which I studied.
Which is probably why the Klan wanted to go there.
Well, supposedly they chose Skokie because it had the highest population of Holocaust survivors.
Oh my God.
In the country. Oh. So they were specifically trying to inflict as much psychological damage as possible. And yet, sure, they should be able to march and they should be able to express their disgusting hatred as much as they would like to. But much like you just said, you know, many men in synagogues, and I'm not drawing an equivalence here, but the way we can miss things, men thinking that feminism has taken care of the
job
issue,
done.
Right? Job done. I think a lot of us thought job done when it comes to Nazis. I can't believe we have had to start talking about Nazis and white supremacists again, and that I have to preach about it. Being the only synagogue within like a 20-mile radius, you know, can be a little concerning. But I have to say, what has been encouraging is right after Charlottesville happened, I put a call out to all the wonderful interfaith clergy that are part of the Valley Shore Clergy Association. We're the only synagogue, but then there's many churches that are part of it. And I said, you know, let's come together this Friday night. Please come to the synagogue, join us for Shabbat worship, and let's stand up to this hatred and show that it's not who we are. And I have to say, so many clergy, we had at least four or five clergy participate in worship. Many of them brought members. We had a candlelight moment at the end where we dimmed the lights and shared one light around. And so as very infuriating as well as sad as it is to see the events of Charlottesville, I have to believe that love will still prevail, that tolerance and acceptance will prevail. And
I must say that one of the things that impressed me about CBSRZ is a lot of the social action stuff that goes on. They're very involved, Paul, with soup kitchens on the shoreline. Mm-hmm. The programs over the years include inviting local imams.
Yes.
I know you took leadership role in that. And that's that stuff is really important. I think one of the, I'm just trying to figure out why I like going to this place in addition to everything that's been mentioned. And one of the reasons is when you're a synagogue, as you say, Rabbi Bellows, like you know, not in the middle of the New Haven, or I grew up in the middle of Los Angeles, where, you know, you're sort of a, like, not, if not a dime a dozen, there are others around. When you're out there semi-isolated, your sense of taking responsibility for whatever it means to be Jewish is more important.
Yeah.
When you're
and then even an Alan Appel will find a need to go to a congregation to be with others. And that's a joke, but I mean that. I mean, sort of the role a congregation can play to help you affirm your identity and be with people with similar background, no?
Yeah, what was the tipping point for you that pushed you towards actually joining?
Boy, you know, I don't all those pestering phone calls from Larry Bloom and other people.
Jewish guilt.
Yeah, it wasn't like a profound to use a Christian phrase, epiphany about anything. Well, we find ourselves in Westbrook increasingly, and I just I think the fact that it's kind of the Jewish headquarters in the area, it mattered to me to be connected in some way, and it's all pre-verbal and visceral, I think, on some level.
So many people getting connected on the shoreline in the next second century, going strong, congregation.
CBSRZ.
Beth Shalom wrote Faith Tzedek.
Yeah.
Chester Schultz.
Come pay us a visit.
So great to hear about the energy and the great stuff going on the shoreline, the Jewish community. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you
for having us.
On High Haven on WNHH Radio. Thank you to Rabbi Marcy Bellows. What a great addition to our Jewish community. I'm so glad you're here, and I hope you'll be coming back.
Thank you. Shana Tova.
Shana Tova. And thanks to Ellen for the history of the House of Peace and Justice, the first 100 years of the congregation. Beth Shalom Brod Petzedek, soon to be made into a major motion picture.
And thanks to Alan Appel, the New Haven Independence star reporter and Haftorah reader for the days of all. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all week long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.